Clubhouse.
Welcome back to another episode of Pod Clubhouse's Tales from the Shogunate, a Shogun companion podcast. This is Paul with my co-hosts Inez and Gabby. How are you guys doing tonight?
I'm happy.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm Gabby, and all I can say is wow.
Happy and Gabby.
Happy and Gabby here.
This is for the sixth episode. This one was called Ladies of the Willow World. Ladies of the Willow World.
I love the title.
It sets the tone, doesn't it, for what to expect in this, I mean, the bulk of this episode.
It's so good.
All right, Gabby, let's hit that synopsis for this episode. This was it was the same amount of time as the other episodes, but it felt denser, maybe with the flashbacks in combination with the other timeline. But I thought there was a lot of story to be told. All right, so first up, we learn that both Ochiba and Mariko have a long and intertwined history together that I didn't expect to see, but now that I do see some of these flashbacks, it's very interesting, and I want to see more about it.
Yeah, and then Anjin gets a big promotion for saving our Toronaga.
Both a general and an admiral. I mean, that's some funny military. Next, we had a chat between Toranaga, who sounds like he has to just sit and listen to whining all day, because he had Buntaro up first with him having to be scolded publicly, and then Blackthorn saying that he didn't want the job.
Yeah, and then he even chatted with Mariko a little bit. She got her little scolding too. But then we see our guy, Hiromatsu, get a warning from his family and then head over to Toronaga to warn him of what was happening with Ishido and Lady Ochiba.
That's when they talked about this thing called Crimson Sky. Got all the old guys very excited.
Right. So excited that Toronaga...
Heavy breathing.
Yeah, sure. So Toronaga just needed, you know, Blackthorn to feel some excitement since he wasn't in, and decided that he needed to get down with Kiku.
Kiku, the town top shelf courtesan. After that interesting encounter, Mariko went to chat with Toronaga, and she learned something about her dad that she didn't know.
Yeah, and then the regents had their vote because Ishido managed to fill that fifth seat. However, Sugiyama voted no.
And for his effort, he got killed the next day.
So that brought us back to Toronaga, who said Crimson Sky is a go.
Crimson Sky is a go. All right, guys. How did you guys feel seeing a very female-centered episode this week?
Oh, man. Well, I mean, lots of intrinsic evaluation, probably like questioning my sexuality after this episode.
Oh, my.
Because these women were exquisite, and they were poised, and they were live art. I really loved seeing like the stories, the female perspective, like in this world. I felt like we've learned to kind of like peel back some of these layers without them having to say what the layers are. Like, I just really thought there was some really beautiful conversation. Yeah, it was wonderful.
Yeah, and an insane amount of quotable quotes in this episode. So I think the last episode was full of a lot of female like vulnerability and fear. And this episode had a lot of power and control. And that was a contrast from the last episode, but also a refresher. And I think that it's really neat that this episode is kind of, you know, it's dedicated, I guess, to the women. The women did the most, but our synopsis did not include like their storyline. And I think that's not because we're sexist. That's because that should be the bulk of what we talk about, because it was freaking awesome to see these things peel back.
Oh, I didn't see it coming. Like I've been.
Oh my gosh, really?
Yeah, like I've been mentioning how I've been reading the book. Lady Ochiba is someone that is very much on the sidelines of the story. And where Mariko is a primary player in the book, at this stage of the story, she is in her feelings about Blackthorne. Like, it is undeniable their crush on each other. And in the show, they are not admitting that to that at this point. You know, they're very strongly resisting it, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think that I really felt it. I really felt like the infatuation or the care or love or affinity, whatever you want to call it. I thought it was really strong, but obviously I think that if they made it any more obvious, either one or both like could die. So I feel like that's probably a realistic way and a nice reference and reminder of like those three hearts.
That came up again, didn't it? The secret heart of Toranaga.
Yeah, and how Lady Ochiwa knows it.
Then let's dig in, I guess, to the ladies, specifically the stuff that happened in all the flashbacks. Let's just kind of do that in one bunch.
Yeah, I love that you are telling us right now, on the fly.
It's called calling an audible. Yeah. So 22 years ago, turns out that's when Mariko's life started to take its current path. We got to see some young Toranaga there, right? They put some hair color back in his wig and youthened him up a little bit.
Oh, that's funny. I hadn't noticed, but...
My man looking good.
Yeah.
Yeah, always. He's ageless. It's timeless, so I didn't even notice.
Oh, I saw that. Was it you that posted that video of that montage of the majority of the roles that he's played since he was like 8 years old?
Affirmative. That was me.
Yeah. He is a movie star, that is for sure. But anyhow, what did you guys get out of any of those early scenes? I'm talking about the little girl scenes before anybody's betrothed to anybody.
Oh, yeah. When they were themselves. Yeah, definitely like two. They are like yin and yang. They are like the Pisces fish. They together make one whole, it seemed. One scene that really stands out was the one where our little Ruri, right? It was Ruri before she was Lady Ochiba.
Yeah.
Right. She got into bed and Mariko was already laying there and she like scooted in and then they both, she laid in bed. They're not facing each other. And then they both scooted to like touch each other's backs, obviously. Obviously because they are like each other's everything. They're each other's best friends. It actually reminded me of Inez and myself in our like life before, but it was usually Inez scooting in and snuggling me before she hit me really hard with a pillow on the face, but whatever. Anyway, sorry. Super cute moment, really sweet. And it really started this whole like duality that we're going to see throughout the rest of the episode, I thought, between the two of them. So it's kind of sweet and heartbreaking.
Once they get a little older, with like specifically the sparring scene, I think you start to pick up a little, is it rivalry perhaps?
I didn't see that as rivalry at all. I saw it as reinforcing the point that I just made that they together make one complete because they are so different, right? Because Lady Ochiba / Ruri, she was not fighting, right? She was just watching and she looked really proud of Mariko for continuously winning her spars. While she was like looking at Mariko like in kind of admiration and like proud, Mariko was looking to her dad for that like validation. And I don't think she really got it. But then also, you know, her next win, she saw Buntaro. And I guess it was sad to see her go from like being excited to make someone proud to like seeing this duty and like the life like come out of her.
Knowing from that later discussion that the setup with Buntaro and basically getting her into Toranaga's clan, that was kind of a setup that was totally intentional rather than a worthless alliance. Did it give you any other feelings about that kind of the distaste that she had and sort of the reticence she had getting in the palanquin? That's it. Palanquin? Is that it? Yeah. Palanquin.
Not a litter box.
Nope, palanquin. But you see, she did that very deliberately, and I understand that there's a certain amount of ceremony and lack of alacrity in these kinds of things, but I don't know, it still looked like, man, I don't want to do this to me.
Oh man, you really Paul, you just like zoomed all the way forward. Like you're just
I'm just kind of blending them together a little bit, but we're gonna hit all the other stuff.
Yeah, no, you mentioned a lot. No, she, yeah. I mean, we called it. Inez and I called it. We called that Torunaga. I mean, Inez, I think, brought it up at first, saying, like, is this Torunaga's long game? And then I jumped on that bandwagon and said, yeah, like, he's probably a piece of shit who's going to use her to make a big kill later on. Like, she's a secret weapon. And then, yeah, it was not fun at all to freaking, like, have that just laid out for us. Because I feel like this was Torunaga who was, like, all about pulling the strings and being the puppet master behind her dad, who said, like, okay, cool, like, we'll give you purpose because, like, you don't fucking matter, little girl. So yeah, I was not happy, very conflicted, right? Because I've been super pro Torunaga, but I'm also pro Mariko, and now I'm like, this motherfucker.
So like, but that,
many feelings.
That'd mean that for years, or for at least months, because we see, you know, there's some disapproval of like the beheadings and all that that her dad shows, that we can understand to carry through to his actions of deciding to kill Gurudah. But I guess we're to understand that I don't know, he was going to kill his daughter's best friend's dad.
Okay, so like talking about that, I didn't look this up, and maybe I should right now before I say anything, but I do know that before when, you know, these warlords / conquerors and like war rulers of like these provinces, when they would kind of take over somewhere and establish an alliance, they would trade hostages.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so, like, was she one of those? Was she, like, one of those little trades with Lady Yoshiba's dad?
Gurudah,
yeah. So was she, was Mariko, like, Gurudah's hostage? And we just didn't see, like, the other half? Because why else would she be, like, having to live and be raised by them?
Great question. Because that first scene, doesn't he say something... Like when she gets out of her little palanquin, doesn't he say something to the rest of the men standing there about this is my vassal's daughter or something? Something to suggest like I'm keeping this group very close, maybe not hostages in name, but in everything else.
Yeah, I mean, back in these like times, that was actually super common that like from alliances or family, whatever, like you do like host, like kind of like foreign exchange student, but like with the like royal families or whatever, where, you know, something that's like part of like negotiations of like molding them to be under their service, like this intern, but they are like from somebody else's like camp. Like that was a common kind of practice in all of these like older empires. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's the word. Yeah, it's also like a bartering card to like honor whatever the negotiation was
to make. Yeah, and if you don't, then we'll kill your precious one that you gave us.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, so they didn't explicitly say that, but that's what I'm assuming it was, because that did happen. So yeah, anyway, that's why she was there. Sure. Little girls hit it off. For sure.
Both girls had different sides of the same coin in terms of like a similar memory, which was the night when her dad did the deed, shot his shot, if you will. and both of them needed to be whisked away from the castle to wherever they were going. I guess Mariko needed to go with her husband and Ochiba needed to go anywhere but there. Mm-hmm. And that's, I guess, the frame of all of their actions after that.
If we could just go back a little bit, sure, to build up to this point. So, like, in the training scene, right? After Mariko, like, is hosted now living with her new family, she's doing her training. Like, we see how the Taiko's, or the Shogun, like, not, yeah, like the ruler, the person who was on top.
Yeah. In that case, in the book, they kept referring to him as the dictator. But in this, they just call him Gurudah, is by name.
Gurudah. I need to. Okay, Gurudah. I'm going to write that down. Okay. So what I really enjoyed about the timeline or the storyline with the ladies were all of the conversations. And as I said earlier, like the quotable quotes. And so one thing that Oshiba said to her, one of the first things she says to her before she gets married off, right, with Buntaro, she says, "We have every privilege. Let us choose to look away from things we cannot control." And then they like held hands and they cried. And so this is the second time we see them have a physical connection. The first one was when they laid down and their backs, you know, hit each other after poor little Ruri saw this horrifying thing where her dad was punishing monks because he didn't like them. And he was really, really ruthless. If he's based on Nobunaga, then he was incredibly crazy, ruthless. And so for little Ruri to see that was really traumatic. And so it's, of course, you know, was it Mariko's dad came and said, "You didn't see anything, go to sleep." She goes back to sleep. And then they have that little touch back to back. And that is just like this huge traumatic thing happened. And then boom, that was like her immediate comfort. And it wasn't like she could turn around and tell her what happened. That touch was everything, right? It was so symbolic. It was so meaningful. Like being a girl in a man's world, like being a child who witnessed things and didn't say anything, like just experiencing trauma. It was really touching and really, really big for me. It meant a lot. I guess I like felt the symbolism a lot in that. And so the next time we see them touch was when they held hands and there were tears that were shed. There was very light. But right after that, Mariko's dad added that she's his most cherished daughter. And it pains him that she's like questioning what's going on. But he reminded her, "You have to be obedient. Now I ask that you serve for something greater. Your duty is what endures. There's nothing more. Your duty is what endures. There's nothing more." So first, little Oshiba says that she and Mariko, right, like that they have every privilege. Just look away from the things you can't control. And then this guy is like, "Hey, your duty is what endures. That's nothing more. Like, you aren't a person. Your purpose is all that matters." Mm-hmm. And so that really set us up, I think, for later on, right? Because the first time we met Mariko was when she was talking to Fuji, and she gave that advice to Fuji, like about purpose. And so it's really interesting that we see, like, in Mariko's origin story, whatever little Ruri taught her, she's passing on to another woman for that strength. And it just like shows this connection and how like Mariko basically just had Ruri / Lady Oshiba like to help raise her. Like they raised each other, they had each other, and they really are like living on by the same philosophies. And now we're just seeing how it plays out, right? Because Mariko, like fortunately and unfortunately, was married off to Buntaro. So she technically has like this better life than Lady Oshiba, who was
the consort,
kind of given, yeah, to the Taiko to provide an heir. And, you know, her whole experience was really traumatic, and she just has a shit ton of anger and a shit ton of wrath, and now a shit ton of power that's driven by all that. But again, they're living by the same philosophies, and technically little Lady Oshiba is the one who like had planted this empowerment into Mariko. So it is interesting that we see the same seed and then it's growing out and branching out.
Paul, do we have like an applause sound that we can put in here for that? That was really beautiful.
Oh my God, I thought you were being sarcastic. When we keep talking, I'll keep adding it, but go on, I'm sorry.
insert applause sound here. Yeah, Gabby, that was like so good, because honestly I had a little bit trouble following everything because, you know, my audio issues, my audio processing disorder stuff.
I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, it is funny because I'm like, whoa, like I felt a lot of these things that you said, but I was also had a lot of uncertainty of like everything, because there was a lot, because this episode was so dense, it is challenging to kind of recollect these pieces. But yes, you're right. I recognized also like that bond, the touching, everything. Like, you know, you and I both come from a trauma background at starting around this age. The silence, the camaraderie that comes from like just suffering, but you like, it's just without words. And that physical touch is like, is so much, because it doesn't look like, you know, she doesn't have her family being, it, you know, able to be there for her. So yeah, so I was thinking a lot about what the dynamic is going to be. I'm assuming that we're getting ready to be set up to watch them have a reunion, because she hasn't seen her in so long. And then we also hear, you know, Torunaga's constant plotting and strategy and letting her know he's going to use her. And now it's like, it just in my mind, right? It's like inevitable that his purpose for her is going to be to exploit that closeness. And I think that's where her purposeful mission is, that her dad's mission that didn't get to be completed, that is now her burden, is going to lead us to a Mariko and Ochiba reunion, and at least one, if not both, dead. And maybe it's because Ochiba did grow up with her dad as this horrible dictator. Who knows what either the Torunaga in camp, you know, might think about her capacity to be a psycho as well. Or is she actually manifesting like her inner ruthlessness that she's absorbing from her growing up, and then pairing that with her empowerment? That's what we're watching her doing right now. And yeah, it's kind of terrifying, exciting.
That's an interesting angle, but it makes me wonder, like, what did her dad and Torunaga have in mind all those years ago? Because in their society, Ochiba should have not been a factor in terms of their scheming and political maneuvering and all that kind of stuff. She's, like she says later, she forced fate to look at her so she could scratch its eyes out. So, but I don't know that they could have counted on that back then, and her leading Ishido around by the nose. So the plot that would dictate her duty, Mariko's duty, wouldn't have been to get close to Ochiba, although that may be how they have to spend that duty now. You follow me?
It might not have been the plan way back then when they were like young and to build the bond, but I'm just looking at like the opportunity for now.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I mean, it's very dramatic for them to have had this childhood history, and what's it worth when they meet again as adults after they've gone through so much? Because Ochiba believes that she has earned where she is.
Well, I think that Torunaga isn't, I think he's the schemer behind everything. And he did like pull the strings and lay this out for her dad to die or to take over and then shortly after be executed for it. But I think that he's just a planter. Like he just, you know, makes sure that he plants the seeds everywhere so that he knows that he has enough alliances that when the time comes that anything happens, he has someone to call to do his dirty work. And so I don't think that he necessarily thought that it would play out this way, like Mariko versus Lady Ochiba, but I think that he absolutely knew that this is a strategic plan and she's a valuable source to be like planted right here. And when the time comes, she's gonna... So it's like, keep your friends close, enemies closer. So like the biggest accountability that he would have to like live up to is the fact that Torunaga is connected to this scheme. And so he definitely needed somebody close. He absolutely is manipulating Mariko to just like continue manipulating her like he manipulated the dad to like continue this thing for the sake of like honor or the greater good of whatever. But I think that, I mean, the greater good of, I mean, anybody's greater good is subjective, right? But right now, like, Torunaga is saying the greater good of, like, the country and of the future and the unification of Japan.
What if this, like, whole story ends up showing us, like, hey, by the way, the Council of Regents was right in Torunaga's shit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I guess, historically, I don't know. Like, I'm...
I don't know any about the history.
I know, but I'm just saying, I don't even know, like, at what point it's going to be, like, good to even drop a little bit of, like, the actual backstory because of the actual history that, like, these people are
inspired
loosely,
by.
Or not loosely, yeah. Closely, yeah, based and inspired by. So, like, if you go by that, then, yeah, that's exactly what the situation is. But, you know, we're going by the book. So I think that the book, you said, was a little bit different from this. And so I think that's really funny, right? You have like what I guess historians might say, and then you have the book, and then you have what we're watching. And what we're watching, I think, is probably taking the book and making it a little bit more like not historically accurate, literally and technically, but technically more historically accurate, like as far as how things, something might go, but it's not really based on the actual history of what happened. It's definitely like a marriage.
The more that I get into the book and deeper into the show, the more I'm starting to see what they were trying to do with the adaptation in this series, which I believe it's not like de-whitewash the book, because I think that the point of view of the book was to, and remember this came out like 1975 or something like that. So World War II was, sure, 30 years gone, but that's still kind of like living memory for the people that were alive right then, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was still very unknown to most people. Middle America, you know, good old Middle America. So there needed to be some kind of way to tell this historically inspired story. They needed an in. So how do you do that? Well, you put a white guy in the middle. And not only do you put a white guy in the middle, but you kind of play up his role a little bit.
Yeah. He's the hero.
Yeah. So I haven't gotten to the end of the book. I don't know if he literally, you know, saves the day or anything like that. But I can tell from what they're doing with the show that they're doing the same thing. They're giving us that same point of view. However, what he does doesn't really matter. He can have his ship, he cannot have his ship, he can have the cannons, not have the cannons, but it doesn't, I don't know that any of that's going to really matter to what Torunaga's going to end up doing. And I think that's right.
Yeah, not to what he's going to end up doing, but maybe I'm still holding out for like him actually being beneficial to, I don't know, them pulling out some secret weapon, which are the cannons.
So, yeah. Well, that's what they're playing it as. Gabby and I both watched the Netflix History of the Samurai, which kind of leads up to this part of history. You'll be interested to know, Inez, that they never mentioned white guys except once. The Portuguese originally brought rifles to Japan. That was the only mention of any kind of intervention about that sort of thing. But the cannons, on the other hand, that never came up. Do you recall that ever being a factor?
No.
Rifles? Yes. Cannons? No.
I'm still on the very... I haven't finished the last episode, so I am holding out. But yeah, I saw in another documentary where they discussed cannons, but in this one, so far, nothing.
I mean, they're very dramatic. So the effect they have on battle is going to make for some great TV. And so maybe that's one concession to making entertainment versus a documentary.
Right. I mean, there was, though, like a documentary that was just about this. But also, one thing that they did say is that, like, in Japanese history, like, some of their stories or part of their history ends up, like, tangenting from somebody, some random person, like, landing on their island and then just, like, making a big difference. And I don't know if they meant that as far as, like, this is, like, a story that they're using to, like, tell to keep morale high or something. Like, is it a story? Is it, like, kind of a myth? Like, is a story loosely based off of something that is, like, glamorized for the sake of nationalism? Or is it actually, like, kind of, is there, like, more validity to, like, the impact? So I don't know about that. But, like, I have seen things that are specifically about this. So about him, about the white guy with the cannons. So I need to do more research. But yeah. Anyway, going back to, like, the ladies, there are two, if I can, like, go back to them.
Sure.
So yeah, there's kind of two storylines. So okay, so first off, this episode was called
Ladies of the Willow World.
Ladies of the Willow World, right. And I kind of really saw like the duality in this episode. So Mariko said something to Toranaga in the very beginning.
Was it during the meeting where Blackthorn's like, I don't want to be the general?
Toranaga called Buntaro to like scold him for beating on his wife. And then after that, he talked to Blackthorn because Blackthorn had a question about getting his ship back. And then after that, Toranaga pulled Mariko aside and, said that he was like suspicious of what was going on between them. And when he's talking to Buntaro, I think it's like important for us to note that like he said that like he loses himself around her. And so that's like why he ends up caring so much that he's like aggressive toward her, I suppose. After Toranaga hears him talk about this, first he says, okay, divorce her. And then he says, like, you don't want to divorce her, then go away for a week. So then right after that, he talks to Mariko. And obviously Buntaro is jealous. And he's taking it out on her. But then, like, he goes from that to having a conversation with Mariko that is like, hey, you can tell that he knows there's something between those two, Anjin and her. And so it's really interesting. And of course, what you would expect from Toranaga, I think, as like being like this colder leader, you have to be. Is that he's, I guess, for their own good. Like, he's like, hey, you need to take him to the brothel so that he can pillow someone. And actually, I think you should join him just in case while he's pillowing, he like says something that I should know about. And so, you know, on one end, you're like, I mean, you can see this in so many ways, right? First and foremost, it's like, wow, what a fucking insensitive asshole. Second, it's like, well, no shit, he has to be insensitive because he's like the leader. The person at the top is the loneliest person. And he's like trying to kind of protect his people who are close to him so that they don't like get messy. Because again, everyone has one objective and one utility. And like, if they start messing with each other, then they're going to get emotional and that's just going to throw anything off. So I understand from like a leader tactical perspective that he's keeping everyone separated and reminding them of their duty. In the emotional perspective, right? It's like, what a piece of shit, right? Because I'm here for like Mariko and her sad love story that's not going to end well. So during that conversation, she mentioned to him that men go to war for any reason. They go to war for...
Yeah, it was like pride power. And yeah, all those different reasons, right?
Yeah, they go to war for another reason, for a purpose. But women are at war constantly. And so she says this to Toranaga, which is like really sad and interesting because it does show you like that a man can like have an actual life and then his purpose is like to win or to do something. And her purpose is her existence, which is based despair just 100% of the time because she doesn't have a right to anything at all. Like nothing. She doesn't have a right to her body. She doesn't have a right to her feelings. So going back to what Lady Ochiba said, which is look away from what you cannot control, right? So the next time that you see Lady Ochiba and she's, getting married off to the Taiko, when she's there to serve her purpose, which is like, you're a vessel and you are like our last hope for like making an heir because this guy is just shooting blanks. And so she goes through so much. And that scene where there's like an intimate scene, this is very different from all the rest of the intimate scenes that we've seen, which were, this is just like from above. And then you just see him and he's kind of like coming at her. It's very non-consensual. Kind of the first one that we've seen that's non-consensual. And she just looks away and it pans on to her eyes looking away. That's something that she cannot control. And that is her having absolute power and control in the only way that she can. But when you see her eyes, there's war. Like you see wrath and anger and despair and sorrow. You see everything, but it's just like powerful when it's in Lady Ochiba's eyes. And then when you see that same sorrow in Mariko's eyes, anytime she talks about this thing, like they're both talking about the same things and how they're using this philosophy to like just exist, like barely survive the day and the tasks they have to go through. And Mariko's are like pain and sadness. So it's like, it really is just like a yin yang. And I mean, they're just the opposite here. And so I thought that was really powerful and interesting that she said that to him right after, like, we had seen this last scene of like this closeness and duality between she and Lady Ochiba. But also, speaking of duality, so sorry, with this whole episode, I just saw like they always had like really intense emotions and like an intense quote like come out of one person, and then boom, they pan to another person that was like basically the male version or like the opposite of like what she is. And they showed both of those. They showed like both the female and male struggle of the same situation. And just going back, like, we're touching on the beginning parts of like Mariko and Lady Oshiba's duality, like when she looked at Buntaro, right? Like when she was doing her spar, right? That special moment, like that she was trying to have with her dad. And then she looks at Buntaro, who she's about to marry. She was just like empowered and ready and happy. And then it shows Buntaro looking at her, and he did not beat her with that because he is a warrior. Like he showed the exact opposite emotion of just like, I don't show my emotions. I can't show my emotions. I am like a tool. I am just a tool that someone else is controlling. And so it was kind of like a sad foreshadowing of like, this is the girl who she was. And then once she's married, that's what she's going to have to become.
Wow.
You should breathe, Gabby.
That's a lot. But I get what you're saying. My little brain understood the connection to opposites. Like, like the beginning of the episode, they are gathered to bury their dead. I assume that's what that big pit was.
Mm-hmm.
And they end that scene following, you know, the bequeathment of Blackthorn's new ranks with that hi, hi, ho cheer. And they do that again at the end when he declares Crimson Skies go. Kind of like a bookend, but for different reasons. He's charging up the crowd for different, like, kind of like opposite reasons. You know, like, we survived this natural disaster. Now we're going to have to go cause a natural disaster up in Osaka. So I got that connection. And now I can see, like, what you were saying, Gabby, that it was stitched throughout the rest of the episodes, especially with the women's perspective. The rest of the plot, I'm not so sure about, but the story told about the women, yes.
Okay, interesting. I mean, I saw it again, like, I guess in every scene, even the ones that were like the flashbacks and the present ones.
Well, I mean, that's what I mean about the Ochiba and Mariko, but I'm talking about like Hiromatsu scenes. Did that have like a balancing scene elsewhere? I'm not so sure.
Oh, right. Well, yeah. I mean, the next thing I can think of was Omi with...
Sad Omi.
With Kuki or Kiku.
Yes. Kiku. Yes, you got it.
Speaking of Kiku, that intimate scene when they're there at the consort, like the entire experience that they create for their clientele is very beautiful. It was, like I mentioned earlier, it was like live art. I respect a lot like their dedication to practicing many years, studying like the perfect way of like pouring the sake or pouring the tea, the way they move. But like getting to see like professional courtesans with Ochiba and with Kiku was just so stunning. I really love their movements and their faces when they're speaking, their eyes, the way that their eyes are gliding across, that, you know, like everything is so fluid. And it was so nice. And then knowing that, like, beneath all of that, like all of that is a facade, right? For an experience for whoever they're serving. But beneath them, like all of them kind of have this underlying like understanding and respect of what they're going through. You know, I really loved the quote. I think Kiku says, "A woman cannot look away when another suffers." That is like, you know, and then pairing that also with knowing that like women are always at war, which is like so true. It is still like how it is today. I could really appreciate that. Like there's this entire like subculture or, you know, entire like existence that's happening that the men don't, like on a plane that the men don't even understand. And I think that's like really special. So keeping that in mind, when Kiku invites Mariko to join her and Anjin in the private room, do you think that she is doing this out of like a kindness? Do you think that she's trustworthy, or do you think she's too loyal to Omi?
Well, she's a professional, so the loyalty to Omi is actually completely superseded by her sense of duty. Like, this is her job. Mm-hmm. It's hard not to confuse some book details with show details, but I think it's a kindness, because, you know, it's not a madam, believe it or not, it is called a mama-san. Her boss saw the connection between Blackthorn and Mariko and kind of flaunted it a little bit throughout the negotiations and their initial introductions and all that stuff. She emphasized, we have this private setting where anything can go down. And if you notice, when she emphasized the privacy, that's when Mariko acquiesced and raised the price up a little bit that she was willing to pay, as if to say, okay, I'm kind of interested in that.
Oh, I didn't get that.
But when the moment came, she did not take her up on the privacy, because I think I got the subtext as like, anything can go happen in that room. It doesn't necessarily have to be Kiku and Blackthorn.
Yeah, and so that was really fun. Actually, I was like trying to decide who to trust, like when they were talking about that. As soon as Mariko like showed up on the premises, right, she said that women aren't allowed there. So that was one thing, like that was special that she was allowed to be there on the grounds. But then she said immediately, like, sure, that Kiku or her boss said that there's privacy. Yeah, there's privacy, whatever. That was like the introduction. But Mariko said, and she was really serious about it when she said, like, be very careful about what you do, because there are eyes everywhere. So I think that gossip would have absolutely left that place. I think no matter what, I didn't think that they were protected at all and that there wasn't any privacy. But maybe Kiku was saying that there would be to entice her to fuck up.
because again, it's kind of like a test yeah, for Mariko, like from everything that everybody's speculating.
Yeah.
That, like, do you think it, like, Todonaga's making this a test for that in general, for like all of like the community's curiosity?
Yeah, no, I think that it could be for any of them, whether it is for Torunaga. I mean, because Torunaga is going to find out based off of the community, right? But then also you could say, like, she likes gathering information and she likes leveraging that information. So this could also have been something that she would use, like, with Omi if she needed to. I think that in the beginning, like especially when they walked in and then started doing the negotiations, Kiku thought, right? She thought that this was with Torunaga, that yes, that she wasn't going to pillow with Blackthorn, right? So when she asked for the 600 or 500? The 600.
I didn't write it down.
The high number.
The high number, right?
Yeah, she she thought it was for Torunaga. And then as soon as Mariko let her know that it was for Blackthorn, her face was like it changed. And I think it was completely because, like, he is still kind of like seen as the other, like the barbarian. I know he's Hakamoto, but to everyone, like, they're still not used to it and they still don't really like it. And I think she knows like how that would impact her in her status, but also her with Omi. I think that she actually does love Omi, or have not love as much as she can love him, because you're right, Paul, like at the very end of the day, like, she's a woman who does her duty and she has to, otherwise she's gonna die, because any man can kill her and it's fine. So I think that, like, in the beginning, she was just like not appreciating at all, like, that it was with Blackthorn, and she was put in a position of like, oh, I don't want to do this, but whatever. Yeah, I think they were toying with each other, right? Because they were testing each other, I felt, where Mariko is kind of just like, are you gonna do your duty or not? And then Kiku is, you know, saying like, oh, well, this is your guy, so go ahead. Like, if you want to be part of this, then you can be, I guess. And so I think, though, when she finally got to the part where you're talking about, Inez, where she said that women like feel, or women cannot look away, I think she noticed, like, during all of this, during the negotiations that were like amazing, because both of them had like the best poker faces. It was really nice watching them do this with each other, which was like really sad though, right? Because, right, there's a disaster that just happened. And so Kiku comes in there and like compliments their cup, right? But I didn't see that many cups. Usually they have more dishes. And so Fuji like let her know that most of their dishes like broke and that these were not special. And I thought that was like a really cute part that Fuji like had. She had to make sure like that she's taking care of the house. So anyway, it was just really interesting how like you saw glimpses of maybe like their actual emotions and feelings of like where they were coming from. But then it was immediately covered up with like their poker faces and they're doing the duties like on behalf of like these other people. And so, you know, she complimented the cup and then Fuji says like there's not a lot. I didn't see as many dishes. So that was really sad that they just experienced this loss. And now they're like, OK, let's keep going. Nobody gets to care about the people who died or, you know, how inconvenient it is that most of our stuff is gone. So we can't even like follow these like rituals and ceremonies properly. Anyway, but then at some point, I think Kiku noticed like the love or deep care that Mariko has. And so I think when she stepped aside behind Mariko and was like having her translate and kind of have this like intimate moment between Blackthorn and Mariko, I think that there were two reasons she did that. One, because she had empathy for her like fellow woman of both of them are doing something that they don't want to do, but they're doing it because it's their purpose or it's their duty. And then the other was, I think she was just being a really great professional, which is making it easier for Blackthorn to follow through with like his duty, which is whatever Torunaga said he has to do, which is pillowing her. And that's like his foreplay basically, because she still has this reputation to uphold, which is being the best at what she does. And he obviously was not about it when he first went in there.
Let me give you the book version of how this went down in a nutshell. And it's very different. How would you react to learning that the idea of Blackthorn needing to get his brains pillowed out was actually Mariko's and not Torunaga's? And the whole thing was set up by Mariko because they had, like you said, too many eyes on them at this point in the story, but she wanted him to have some pillow action, but she couldn't do it herself. So she hired Kiku.
Oh my gosh.
I think Jesus that's really Christ. Smart. I think that was really smart. If you're trying to like get the trail off of you and she's an intelligent woman, then you're going to do what you need to do to like survive, because this is death that she has to face if she gets this wrong. So
I don't remember who the author is though.
Yeah. So like there was the scene where they first meet Kiku. It actually involves like Kiku pulls out all of her tricks. The tea pouring is one part of it, and she is, you know, well practiced at that part, but she also played instruments, sang songs, like the whole nine yards.
Did they have her student come in too? Like they did?
I don't recall that, actually.
I liked that. I really liked that. I really liked having like the insight of like that she's a master and she's got apprentices.
Yeah, and that's way more like seemingly historically accurate than how the other one would go down, I think. One seems kind of like a white man's fantasy.
Oh.
And then this one seems
You remember what I put in the group text about Kiku and her broad selection of dildos and other things? Well, that was from book.
Because
they had to bring all that out and show them around. And yeah, so that was all in the book. But where it starts to run back together is at the end of that sequence when Kiku walks him all the way out to the town. And you might have noticed that the entire fucking town was out there.
Waiting, yeah.
Well, apparently if your courtesan isn't that impressed with your pillowing, then she just like closes the gate behind your ass and you have to walk to town by yourself. But the fact that she came out and exchanged pleasantries in front of everybody, including Omi, that was indicative of something to the rest of the town. Like, oh, she came out with him like that.
Ooh,
yeah,
she got some of that. ADHD.
Yeah.
I think that maybe some of that reason that she did that was to help protect Mariko, right? Because the town is saying all the stuff that's putting her life in danger. Not so much Blackthorn, but definitely hers. And I mean, both of theirs, but mostly hers. And so I do think that this was her, like she was sacrificing like her relationship with Omi because Omi knew what was going on. And she did that like for her like camaraderie with Mariko to protect her, I think. And the speculation and maybe now there's like more respect to like the situation that Mariko is in as the translator always having to be by his side.
I don't know if I am pillowing the one of the highest ranking people now in the town, if I'm going to publicly humiliate them either way. Like, let's say she pillowing Torinaga and it was terrible. I think she still would walk him to his door because it's Torinaga.
Right. But there's no respect for Blackthorn as Hatamoto at this point.
Well, on paper, there is. On paper, it is.
On paper.
He is official. Right. So that's what they would be honoring, right? Because that's the professional part. It's like, even though I don't respect him as a person, it is what is
it's
like
what
in...
you do.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering if that can play it more so than anything. So she's not going to do that to like a high ranking person. If you're like professional and the best, it's because you know how to like keep your bridges. It's like this. And, you know, I was looking up, I think the negotiation ended up at 300 monies or monies, right? Mm-hmm. So that's about $200 US dollars. And for that time, it's a significant chunk of money for that time. But I just want to throw my little piece in because I've been quiet over here. We forgot about the middle child over here, guys.
I think
I know where you got the 600 from. That was how much his income was from his fief.
So he 600
koku, right?
600 koku, yes, which I looked it up also.
Is like an allotment of rice. It's like
an allotment of rice. And ChatGPT does an estimate after its analysis, estimates to be valued about 67,500 annually.
Going back though to that scene, that conversation, the pre-pillowing / negotiations.
That was a great scene.
During like the foreplay explanation too, I thought it was really interesting that Kiku starts explaining like when she stands like kind of to the side behind Mariko so she can directly translate. She's explaining that people go there to forget something, whether it's boredom, pain, hardship, disappointment. It's a place of physical pleasure where people who wish for a different life or a different circumstance can like find relief from it, right? And so she starts then like saying very specifically, like kind of speaking through Mariko. And she gets to a point where the last line, I don't know if you noticed, but Mariko did not translate it. And in the last part, so it seems like they're both getting into it. Blackthorn and Mariko, right, are like imagining that the words being translated are coming from Mariko so that Blackthorn is focusing on what he desires, which is Mariko. She says, like, at the very end, I ask you to be here with me now. Mariko did not translate that. Instead, she had her flashback of her father being killed. And it takes her to a flashback that I'm assuming is her father being killed, but we didn't get to join her in that flashback being elaborated on at all through the rest. It was just like a new one that was really short. And so that to me was like, I don't know, I didn't expect that, right? Because you're getting into it, seeing that this connection is happening and like you're kind of sad about this like tragic thing that's going on between them, this like tragic love. And then as soon as it gets to the climactic part, boom, like she's met with her trauma because that is actually the thing that she's like trying to escape. So it's interesting that he went there they both kind of originally went there to escape like this attraction they have of each other. It has to be broken. The bond has to just, they have to not look so close. And so this is like a big, know your side, know your position, like get yourself together. Stop fucking around with each other. And then boom, like her actual trauma comes out, which is, I mean, it just shows you that like she's not present, like the Eightfold Fence. There's a lot of stuff that's inside of her that this place of pleasure like did bring out to her. And again, people go there to run away from their boredom, pain, hardship, disappointment. And for her, it was absolutely like her pain and her trauma. I mean, that was totally intentional. And it hit me like pretty significantly. And then as soon as that happens, right, like Kiku asks Mariko if she like wants to go, and then Mariko says no because she's like establishing that boundary and she's like thickening that line between them. That's when Blackthorn like walks away and touches her hand, and that I'm like, oh my god, like did someone see that? Like did you guys just blow everything, or like is this a special moment that like I can go ahead and appreciate and like feel safe about? That was really sad and significant. I wanted to know what you guys thought about it.
Sexy.
Okay. Got it. It was sexy.
Yeah. I mean, I try to look at it for what he might be feeling at, like, and he has not a lot of choice in this. I guess he could refuse, but he's so tied up in trying to understand what's an insult and how to get along and all these other things that the boss said, go have sex. And he doesn't particularly want to, even though he's, you know, Kiku's putting on a pretty good show, but still what's he supposed to do here? But his feelings are still right there. And then so his little hand just pops right out and grabs for hers. It's, as the kids say, I've been shipping them this whole time anyway. And I know from the book, it's mushier than this. It's a lot mushier than this. I kind of like what they're doing in the show, because I get a sense that their love or whatever it is, their whatever, may not pay off and always be sort of those unrequited, like, or near misses or something, you know, that'll be very exciting to see because you think it might work out, but then it doesn't because, well, we probably think Mariko's toast at some point.
And then you're like pissed forever for the rest of your life of like, why? Why could this not happen? It was so right.
Yeah, but it's like a Romeo and Juliet sort of thing. Just not.
Yeah, forbidden love.
And it's more exciting that way. TV. Yeah, yeah.
At the risk of sounding super disrespectful, like I was sexy, Paul. That whole scene was sexy. And like, I was like, you know what? I think I might want to role play now.
That sounds so bad. That wasn't role playing. That was just like
I'll be a courtesan with my husband. So like, I'm gonna be a Japanese courtesan. I'm gonna be Kiku. She was fucking awesome in this thing.
I'll send you a tea set. Get you started.
I have a cute kitty cat one. Maybe I'll try that one. Oh.
So okay, but wait, going back to you guys thinking it's sexy, like remember, like she still has a bruised up face at this point. So I do feel like both of their faces looked really like sad to the whole time. So I'm glad it turned you guys on, but I just could not help the sad eyes. They just were breaking my heart.
We already processed all of that stuff. We acknowledge it and it's beautiful and it's there. So now we also can acknowledge that like as Kiku, as like her profession and her job, we're getting insight into like what a master does in this. Like the fact that they took the time to teach us that all of the details of what these women have like go through, like of their education, like it's an actual like academy kind of thing that they're doing for it. So their craft is like something to be admired. And yeah. I'm just giving it like that sexy mark because I'm like, I am an admirer of this, of the craft. And I just
completely
did it.
Completely objectively, not part of the story. Technically there are tea ceremonies are not just something that the courtesan do, but like they all have tea ceremonies. I think we just haven't seen it because they're super progressive with Blackthorn, because we've only seen Fuji and Mariko with Blackthorn, and they're not gonna like teach him all the ways. They're just kind of his subordinates. But yeah, like the way that they walk, the way that they open the doors, the way that they do everything is, I mean, it takes a lot of practice. And I mean, your whole life is basically an academy. One thing that I thought was interesting, and I don't know if it is on purpose, but Kiku, like so far all the women, and I watch it, like the way that they glide, because the way that they walk is a very, very specific, they are specifically trained to walk this way, period, where you're gliding. And it's those tiny, tiny steps where your knees are really bent and you are just gliding. But Kiku did not glide. as much at all. Like, she had a bit of bounce. So I don't know if that was like a difference in, and I think it might be. I think it might be, showing a difference in like the classes, because everyone in the palace has to glide, but she had a little bounce. And I mean, I don't think that any of the commoners or the villagers like ever have that gliding. Especially they don't.
For some reason,
I thought that was interesting.
For some reason, Kiku remains important in the book, like an object of Torunaga's interest. And so they expand on...
Probably.
Make a point of saying that she is a first class courtesan, and she has been graded for whatever that means. So whoever grades such a thing, it's official by the courtesan Japanese grading council
or whatever. Yeah, she's top rate. She's top shelf. Got it.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I mean, because she's with them at their most intimate and vulnerable places, right? Like the men. And so she knows many, many, many secrets. And that's, of course, why Torunaga has interest in her. He's a schemer. He knows all the secrets by proxy.
Oh, well, he buys her. Many ladies. And that is actually the next negotiation scene between these two women. But I don't know why that would play out in the show at this point, given what happens and how different it is from what happens in the book. I don't know why they would bother continuing that story with only a couple episodes left.
Well, so yeah, so after that, like, Mariko briefs Torunaga. That's when he lets out the big reveal, right, of the grand master plan.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Torunaga doing his thing with the ladies, right? He asked her. I mean, he's just, like, at this point, I don't know about you guys, but I feel like this guy is not slick anymore. Like, do you think he's slick in his manipulation at all?
Slick? Yeah, I do. But maybe I'm just fooled. Because he's a much more even character than the book Torunaga. The book Torunaga is always shifting. He's always playing games with people. He actually acts somewhat crazy in certain scenes, or much angrier than he actually is, because he doesn't want anybody to guess what he's going to do next.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, there's a scene where he has heard within the ranks of his clan that there are men who are going to try and force his son to take his spot. Not Naga, but another son named Sonada, I think. So he calls all of his banners to come to a meeting and says, is anybody in here thinking of treason? And one guy says, yep, me. I've thought of things like that. And he says, go kill yourself. And he does. And another guy says that also. And he says, go kill yourself and your family. And then after that, people kind of, even if they were thinking, they probably don't at that point. And that is in the book when Hiramatsu kind of arrives. And then in the scene with Hiramatsu, he's like, Jesus, I just had to play like I'm a dick with all my other guys. And he's like, well, did you really need to have those guys killed? And he's like, yeah, but I didn't really feel as mad as I looked about it. But only with Hiramatsu was he able to reveal his true feelings, because he's his most trusted advisor. So yeah, he wavers back and forth between someone that kids around with his friend Hiramatsu, and who acts very angry, like insanely angry with people.
Oh, I mean, that's just being a leader, right?
It's different. It's different. In Hiroyuki Sanada's giving a very even, stoic kind of performance, where he's not giving us quite as many swings in the mood as the book version.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I mean, considering what it would take, like, what it would actually historically take to be in that position, I'm kind of feeling like the book version's probably more accurate as to what had to go down in between, like, these events that we're talking about. You don't just rule but with, like, love and admiration. You rule with by fear as well. And there were, especially at this time, like, it was common for people, for family members to like try to overthrow or like kill each other or to actually kill each other for the sake of power. That's really interesting. And I do think that the purpose of this show is to show one face and like kind of a greater good. We don't need to know everything that it took, right? Because this guy at the end of the day is seen as like a hero and a positive person. And so I think they're trying to make a hero and not an anti-hero with this.
I think you're right. What is
it called? This translation or this interpretation of reality. But that would have been crazy to watch. It was, yeah. But I totally understand that as like as a leader where you have to like establish your dominance and, you know, scare people into their place or hold people accountable, etc. So I don't really see it as like being confusing or two-faced, but maybe I'm also just kooky dukes. But in this scene, though, I did see a little bit of I don't know. I did feel a little bit of that. Like I saw like a bit of the, not the dark side, but the other side of him or some side of him because he is really stoic. And so after when Mariko briefs Torunaga on like how it went with Blackthorn and Kiku, Torunaga starts the conversation by saying like, hey, you and Ruri are really friendly with each other and you knew her growing up. What do you think made her this crazy where she'd want to kill me? Can you think of anything? I'm like, this motherfucker. Like, okay. And then he's like, and then the fact that he fucking says all of us had hardship, but most of us do it with honor. Like, really just like talking shit about her and planting this fucking thing of like pinning them against each other of like, you've experienced hardship and you're honorable and she's experienced her hardship too. But like, Jesus, she's just crazy. That's what I got.
You think he was calling Mariko crazy or Ochiba?
Ochiba.
Okay. All right. Good. All right. Same page. Yeah, all right. Like, good. Good.
Pitting them against each other where I'm like, this fucking asshole, he fucking knows what he did and what he's doing. And then of course I love her response, which is meeting him, and that's when she said, most of you are men. A man may go to war for many reasons, conquest, pride, power, but a woman is simply at war. And you know what the fuck he does in response? He laughs. He laughed at her when she said that. She said this thing that was super fucking real and such a response. Like, it was kind of a defense, Lady Ochiba's reaction to everything. That, you know, like, hey, you guys have this reason to do shit, but, like, we have, like, the things that we endure, you don't fucking even know. And so he laughs, and then that's when he starts to plant his little seed of, like, oh, you know what? I can't believe that you didn't know that your father, like, had this plan, actually. We were supposed to have this conversation, and your daddy totally knew. Did you know that? You had to have known. Like, fuck that guy. Like, of course you didn't fucking know, because it's his plan. So in this, I'm like, oh, I was just like this little fucking, I mean, I don't really believe that snakes are bad, but I'm like, I get it. When people are like, this snake, he's over here and he's just like cutting off. He's like a python. He's just like gripping her fucking ankles and he's wrapping around her neck and her body and he's just squeezing everywhere. And he's just like, oh yeah, let me just like poison you with all of this confusion and gaslighting you. And you know what? I'm going to pin you against your sister. And you know what? That's actually what your dad wanted. Your whole life to be. He wanted it to be about you killing her and dying for me. So I thought that his little speech to her, the like reading between the lines of both of them, was just like really, really one powerful, super smart, like as a leader, and exactly what I would expect. And bravo to you, Torunaga. But then as like a lady, I'm like, you motherfucker, like fuck you. You suck.
I don't know that he laughed to denigrate her, but
he laughed.
He did laugh, but I mean, I laugh when I'm not supposed to laugh.
Oh, you think that was a nervous laugh? You think Torunaga has nervous laughs?
No, I don't. I think it was, I guess it is condescending, come to think of it, because all the reasons that I'm thinking that you might laugh in that scenario are all coming from like a, like, look at what the dog said kind of thing. And it, like, of course that's condescending. You know?
Well, yeah. I'm glad you're seeing it that way. Yeah. Just thinking about it a little bit.
Just a little bit. Because initially I didn't see it as completely disrespectful, but yeah, I see what you're saying.
How did you take this scene from the first time? How would you take it?
I did not understand why he thought, maybe it's because she made such an astute observation or comment about women being at war that he figured that she must have puzzled out this business with her father. But I didn't understand that because after her dad killed Ochiba's dad, in the book anyway, Buntaro was so sick of her just looking at her that he sent her away. Guess how long he sent her away?
A year.
8 years.
Oh my.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And but still,
where did he send her?
I don't remember. But it still did not grant divorce, did not grant seppuku, just forced her to stay married, just be away and then come back. And I don't think that that's in the timeline of the show, but still gives you like an idea of where they were coming from with their relationship, the ice that Buntaro has mentioned.
I don't know. Like, I don't think so, though. I think that like the movie or the show is going a different way about it, because how would she be showing ice for all of those years if she was gone? Like if that was supposed to have happened in the show.
Right. That's what I'm saying. I don't think they're reflecting that in this show, but they are showing that they are not a good match. And never really have been.
Like it was just obligatory for both of them.
Well, yeah. Yeah. It was a political thing on the surface, but a scheme beneath the surface. But what I was getting at was that I don't know how she would have come to understand anything being so socked away from everybody. You know, I don't know what her life was like previous to being the translator for the Anjin, but I imagine as Buntaro's wife, she didn't really float around in Torunaga's tea parties on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she just made friends with the Catholics.
Yeah, yeah, you got it. So, and Torunaga he's not interested in any of that. So, how?
Because he was gaslighting her.
Well, there you go, possibly. Because what additional
and
input?
Gaslit you.
Yeah, I have to admit it.
You're so gullible. As in, what have we learned? Torunaga, what he says is not what he actually means. There's like 10,000 layers, right, that you have to go through.
He's like an ogre because he's like an onion.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yes, I was going to finish it, but you're too quick. Okay, so you were gullible. What did you think, Inez?
I did not catch it the way that you captured it, Gabby. I don't think that I was feeling very gullible either in like just taking whatever Torunaga is saying at face value, because like I acknowledge like that the emotions of what these women have gone through since they were little girls, especially like Ochiba, Mariko, like I do have a tendency to be more empathetic to whatever might be motivating them that I'm not going to hear like specifically in the words or whatever. Like, I feel like I kind of will understand where they're coming from. But I think I was just like absorbing this and just, yeah, just like hearing, okay, this is like what he's saying about it. And this is what she's saying about it. But now that I've heard your analysis of it, I think that might be more accurate. I did see, you know, him do his like little laugh, and I thought the same thing. It kind of gave me a pause. So I was just like, wait a second, like that was like a reveal, and it was dismissed. Yeah. And you know, and I felt that instantly, like it was a sting in me instantly because of being a woman in still always like at war and being dismissed for my authenticity. I really like the way that you broke that down. I can totally see how somebody could be receiving this message in the show as a viewer, as gullible, because of the way that they started off the, you know, very first episode of making Todonaga, like, really emphasizing hard on honor, honor, honor. And it got to the point that we just have blindly put honor all the way, like, through automatically now, without giving an opportunity that honor could be, like, removed based off of things that you learn. I feel like a lot of people just kind of keep that. So it makes it easy to just accept whatever he says as like, oh, he's just like way smarter than Mariko. But, you know, that isn't necessarily like true. And so her sharing this, but also we spent the whole episode watching women have women, you know, from girls to womanhood. Like, you just saw a camaraderie and understanding and empathy that lasts a lifetime in that way from their unspoken war. So that's why it did sting when he said that. But I can see why, like, the pulse of the world.
I mean, you were one of them too, I guess. You're like, huh, it doesn't feel right, but it's fine. And honor, though, does not mean truth. So I do he is being honorable still. It's just, you know, it's like a guideline. And at the end of the day, his North Star is being Shogun. I'm not convinced of this bullshit of like, I don't want to be Shogun. I don't want to be king. Like, no, you do, guy.
We've seen him do that big old fan thing, you know, that when he first got there, he had the fan, right? Like, bringing everybody up and down. And then he did it again, intentional, again, of the, you know, ho thing. So
he's like Texas A&M Yale leader.
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah. I think kings. That, yeah. So he's just being very convincing of his, like, everybody saw me, how much I rejected this to be the sole regent.
Yeah. He's just reverse psychologying everybody. He's just a smarty pants who does his work behind the scenes, which is why Lady Ochiba also does the same thing, because she knows his shit and she's mad and she's ready to take him out. Which is so ironic, right? Because she just wants to take him out for the sake of vengeance of, like, him being behind her dad being killed, because her dad did the right thing. Like, everybody agrees that it was the right thing. They just didn't want to be the people to, like, do it, because the previous ruler was just a crazy person and it wasn't good for the entire, like, country. So anyway, she's worked her way through, like, surviving everything, kind of worked her way up, and now she has, like, she just wants to get him out, but she knows that Ishido, like, is a weak leader. And she even said that. And even Taiko's wife said that, right? She said that you're choosing the wrong ally because Ishido is good at things, at, like, everything, but not great at anything. And so she doesn't really understand why Lady Ochiba is, like, even siding with Ishido. She also knows that, like, this guy sucks, so she's going to have to be the one who's going to be pulling the strings, because she's greater at more things than Ishido is. He's just a man who has, like, a big army. That's, like, conflicting and interesting, and I'm not really sure, like, how historically accurate that is either. I feel like this is just, like, a nice story to kind of, like, make Toranaga, like, a greater put together, like, hero versus, like, this kind of woman who's being emotional and making these decisions, like, these irrational decisions based off of, like, her trauma or whatever, which, like, Toranaga doesn't do, right? Because he wears his trauma with honor. So anyway, I just feel like this is just fun storytelling at this point. Oh, just the gaslighting was crazy. Like, your father once told me he wished you were born a man. Now I see why. He had great plans for you. And then she laughs, right? And she's like, ugh, whatever. Like, then he should have married me better, right? And that's when he's just like, oh, you didn't know? He wanted to put you as far away from this fight as possible so that you would survive and return to finish it. To finish his fight. Now he's saying, and then, like, when he said that, you have to finish what he started. And she's just, like, so fucking guilty. You see her face? Like, she keeps it together, like, most of the time. And so when I see her face change and her emotions, like, her being vulnerable, it, like, hits me so fucking hard. And I was like, oh no, I think that's when I really, like maybe I was getting gaslit a little bit. No, actually I wasn't, but that's when I started getting really fucking mad. And I'm just like, oh my God, no, like, don't do this to my girl. And then he's like, all of these years, you must have known. And then she immediately just says, I have failed him. And I'm like, this motherfucker. And then he's like, no, Mariko, your war isn't over. Like, he's so amazing. He's such a fucking manipulator. Like, it was so fucking beautiful and sad to, like, see this poor woman just, like, get even more destroyed and more and more and more. And I'm like, this guy's just doing it because, like, he knows that she can fucking take it. As we said earlier, right? She wants to die. She's already dead. She's just fucking floating around, like, doing what she's fucking told because she's totally fucking broken. And he is super capitalizing on that. And seeing him say this at the very end, no, your war isn't over. That is so sad because now, like, Lady Ochiba, you know, she's mad at Torunaga. And then, like, by proxy, obviously upset that Mariko's dad, like, did that, like, he was the one who was the puppet, and now she's gonna see that, like, the daughter is the puppet of Torunaga. So, like, I am absolutely not looking forward to the inevitable scene that we're gonna see with these two amazing women, powerful women, like, going against each other, because the shit that Lady Ochiba is gonna lay on her, and then how it's gonna affect, like, Mariko, like, I can't fucking handle that. But honestly, like, it really breaks my heart also just, like, seeing Lady Ochiba, like, exist and go through everything she's going through. And again, like, they are just two sides of the coin. They are the yin and the yang. These are two ways that, like, complete despair and trauma and, like, hardship can affect a person. One, you can just be totally, like, become a puppet. The other one, you become the puppet master. And that's what we saw there. And not fucking cool. But anyway.
Was that the right time?
Thank you.
I love it. Yes.
Oh my gosh. The vote. We did miss something that I wanted to touch on, I think. But I mean, that scene is like the second to the last. I think the last scene is the voting. Last couple scenes are the voting scenes, right?
Yeah. The regents and that farce of the regents trying to vote in Lord Ito, the actor, going sideways. Kasugiyama's like, nah, I don't think there is a plot to take out the heir. So this is all for nothing. I'm checking out of here.
This is really fucking funny. And again, I don't know about the historical accuracy, but I'm like, is there, like, some kind of sexism happening here or something? Because, like, I love how suddenly they're like, oh my God, Ishido has gone mad. It must be the woman. And I like how Sugiyama was like, nah, I don't like that you are holding people hostage and threatening people. Like, this is not the way. So whether it's from you or this woman, I'm not about it. So yes, I will vote in your favor if you, like, basically get this woman to stop running the show.
Well, so they recognize that the more direct decision-making all of a sudden started appearing when Ochiba made camp in Osaka.
And it is, like, historically accurate to, like, speak so sexist, like, against the woman. I don't think that that's, like, a writing issue for, you know, being, like, inappropriate for, like, us. I think that is just, like, how they really do. They just...
Oh, yeah, I know that. But I'm saying I don't think she actually historically had such a hold on Ishido or on the decision making. That's the part.
You're probably right. I mean, this is
but it's
making the story and the stakes of how the characters are all locked together in something that's gonna have to be resolved much more interesting.
Oh my God, much more interesting. You just need that. You need there to be, like, a lady fight in order to make it interesting. Because I think
it helps.
I guess some hair you're pulling. Right. You are the man here.
like their little fans drop on the floor and scratching and no, and that's not what I want at all.
No, keep going.
No, I don't need that.
No, it's okay. We saw one of your hearts or your one of the eightfold fences go down.
Yeah, you knocked down a fence.
The other side.
Yeah. No, I think they can, but I think there might be something where they, I don't know how they would fight. I don't know that a physical fight's necessarily required, but because we know that Mariko is handy with a pole arm. So we saw her as a kid, we saw her as an adult. Yeah. Go ahead, Ines.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, what if, like, you know, she's, like, assassin trained. So it's like meant to be like, be all like buddy up in there. And then like you just assassinate. Just like, they, I mean, they should, made a point of showing us how that's all done and how people get committed mm-hmm. to that.
You think it's like a foreshadowing?
I think Toranaga was implying that in this.
Yeah, that's what I was assuming. That's what I was saying earlier, that like their face-off is and him exploring that friendship. In my mind, I envisioned that it's because of their closeness and her ability to be close and have a conversation with her or whatever, and then sneak attack.
I like it. Yeah,
that's what I thought too.
I like it.
What did you think? Did you not think anything about the lady storyline at all, Paul? Where it was going?
No. I mean, I did think that there would be some resolution to their conflict, but I did not think that far ahead, I'm afraid, because I'm trying to reconcile what they're doing with the two characters that is completely new and not at all what I'm also learning about their characters from reading the book.
Oh, what two new characters?
Ochiba and Mariko. At this point, they are not resembling their book selves.
Oh, that's what you mean. Okay. Okay, I see. You're a little confused. You're just living in the present.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sure. Like you simpletons, maybe. Like exactly. You commoners.
You got it.
But let me see. So the final scene, though, right, is let's just go with it. I'm going to shut up about like how it veers away from history. And let's go with this wonderful story in front of us. Of course, Lady Ochiba, right, was talking to Ishido about the presence of like the shadows of the Taiko, like everyone's in the Taiko's shadow. So this is after Lady Ochiba like finds out about Sugiyama getting murdered by Ishido, right?
No, because her words compel Ishido to take
do that.
Yes.
Yeah, so that was really fun that she like, I guess, said that, where she was just, she just called him like a plaything, aka little bitch.
And compelled
him to do that. And that was really funny that she was just like, if you do this, then your shadow is going to be the one that everyone's underneath. And I just thought that was so funny and like simple and yeah, realistic of how like men are just like, what? No, I'm really tough. If I do this, will you think I'm tough after that? Are you going to like me then? So that's the vibe I got. And I thought it was really funny.
I read it the same way. I got it. I'm on Team Gabby on this one. I got it.
Yeah?
I got it in the first try. Yeah.
That's funny. Inez, did you even catch that?
I thought it also was kind of funny. Like, he kind of looked like, he just looked like he was like angry in his PJs, like out there. Like, he was like so like annoyed about having to be out here and like intercept this guy. I just felt like he looked disheveled. I thought that was funny because just kind of showing this dynamic of Ishido compared to when we first saw him in the first two episodes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, he's so powerful, he's so big, he was so intimidating, right? And then like he's so small, he's like doing the grunt work now. It's well, so funny.
I might be making this up, but there might be a subtlety there where when word reaches Toranaga, the blame is put onto bandits.
Mm-hmm.
And so it might be that Ishido is not dressing mm-hmm. the part because mm-hmm. he has hired a bunch of Ronin to go and do this. Even though he's got to be there, he can't be there. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I mean, I get that. But like, he's this big, powerful guy and he's out here having to do this bandit work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, where Yabu was his guy before or someone else was the guy.
Right. Yabu did it last time or, you know, was intercepted the dad or whatever. But he's there at the front line. I'm doing this. And he looks like he'd rather be anywhere else.
Yeah, I didn't get that vibe because, you know, they're killing. He needs to make sure that this guy's dead. And I think it's kind of one of those, I want you to know it was me sort of thing.
I don't think that that matters to him more than that. But I think that this is more for like, I think this is more like an artistic decision of how to physically portray him when we're had this great dialogue between him and Ochiba where she calls him a little bitch. And then you see him out there and they make him look like a little bitch.
No. Let's use the real word. She said plaything. And yeah, he did look like a little plaything, a little rag doll on a little horse. No. Yeah. I mean, I thought he still looked badass in his robe, and I was like really happy that I saw him in his robe. And I felt like what I appreciated about this scene though was that Ishido has done some bad shit. Like, he has been completely ruthless earlier, and we like saw him become tamed or something. And then I figured, like, you know, it is the most badass when someone is like super casual about like doing something horrifying. Like, he doesn't have to look big and scary because like he's not with commoners. Sure, it was supposed to be like in secret, but he's also like seeing his equal, because this was a regent, Sugiyama, and like his family, you know what I mean? So like he doesn't need to puff up, because again, anytime he was with his regents, he was like in the robes. And sure, on one hand, like, he is a badass because he's like really powerful with like a big military, but also he's not powerful because as a plaything, right, like he is doing this dirty work, but then at the same time he can do this dirty work like in his
right
casual clothes.
But I think that that's what makes it like so interesting, because we do know all of this about him, and that she's just like made, they spent time in the writing having her make him so small, and having like other people realize like he's small, you know, because she's the one in control. And so I think that's what makes it such a fun artistic decision to have this physical portrayal. I get why, like, being there, yeah, making sure the job gets done. And then you're like, you know, it's not uncommon for like the heads to like lead certain like attacks and whatnot. And I guess he knew this was going to be a really easy fight anyway. Not that he would run away from a fight. I'm not taking anything away from him in that way. I think that that just speaks more to the fact that, like, this guy is so big and powerful, and yet here he is, like, you know, he's so small now in the scheme of, like, the dynamic changes. And I think that was, like, I think just find it really fun.
To add on to that, though, right, Sugiyama like agreed with you, because he did say that he, you know, his last words were, "It was wrong to side with a simple bureaucrat. That's all you'll ever be." And then that's when Ishido killed him. So it looks like everyone has noticed that like he is this plaything, and everyone is now calling it out. And this guy is just taking out his anger in form of murdering entire families. So it's definitely a change of pace, but still just as like gruesome. I think like this ending was just as gruesome and dramatic as like the rest of the endings of the other like former episodes have been. And then finally, that leads us to Toronaga's final speech, where Crimson Sky is a go.
He's had all he can stand, and he can't stand no more. Well, Sugiyama was probably, if he had a chance of any ally regents, then that was it, because it wasn't going to be Ishido, and he couldn't count on the Catholic regents. So Sugiyama was it. And then hearing about the hostages and with from Hiramatsu, it's like things aren't going to get better now. So he's left with no choice, mm-hmm. I suppose.
Who, Toronaga?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he has no allies. It's finally gotten to this point. Were you guys, I know we mentioned this earlier, but were you guys buying this, like, I don't want to be king thing up until this point?
Yes.
Were you?
I did until this episode.
Okay.
I did, like, that he genuinely, like, didn't want it was the sentiment that I had been feeling this whole time until today.
So, okay. It was interesting, though, his last little speech, right? So he said, "I expect to be falsely impeached, and war will be declared on my clan." Like, if war will be declared on my clan, "I desire no lands, I want no honors. But if traitors will like place Taiko's heir in danger, I must defend him." And I'm thinking, like, what's the story right now of how they're like hurting the Taiko's heir? Like, how is that still his argument right now? How is that convincing? Like, how are they putting the Taiko in danger at this point? And how are Toronaga's people like convinced of that? I guess they know that anything has changed, but like we in the audience, like, how are we supposed to buy that? Well, because we see that Ishido is like with Ochiba, and Ochiba seems to love her son. So what's going on?
The original setup for the whole thing was Toranaga had been called to Osaka to answer to the other regions because they thought that he was assuming an undue amount of influence and power, and that under the regency system, he wasn't supposed to do that. And since then, he has been telling us things that he believes that Ishido is actually doing that very same thing by putting the other regents mm-hmm. under his thumb, and it is to take over Japan and not leave Japan just waiting for the heir to come of age. And so, you know, with killing Sugiyama and keeping the other regents' families hostage, then it is looking more and more like he is doing what he said. He, being Ishido, is doing what Toranaga said he was doing the whole time.
No, sir. Okay, no, even though he knows that, like, Lady Ochiba is supposedly behind it.
Well, but Ishido was doing that stuff before. Who knows? Maybe if we read into it, the reason that, remember, Ochiba had been taken to Edo Castle, and that was part of the reason why they were worried about Toranaga, because they were thinking that he had taken her hostage.
Do you think that he didn't take her hostage? Because she seemed like she felt like she was taken hostage.
Well, I mean, there's hostage and then there's hostage, I suppose.
Oh, yes, I see. Thank you. Never thought of it that way.
Yeah. I mean, she was free to go after it was made clear that he couldn't keep her. So that's not a real hostage, right?
Well, that was a hostage negotiation, and that was a term that he fulfilled. I think that classifies as a hostage. Because I assumed in the early episodes that I believed him. He said, I'm not keeping her against her will or whatever, but that she did come back feeling it. I believe her and her experience. You know, at first I thought maybe she would say and do this because of some kind of like collaboration she had with Toranaga. Obviously, this episode dispelled any of that possibility of that thought train. She hates him completely. He is aware that she hates him and he's working around all of that. So,
yeah. So, no, I guess I was trying to say, like, where is the audience supposed to be at this point? And I like, it seems like the audience is supposed to be kind of confused and as to, like, all the layers and not knowing, like, who to ally with. But, I mean, it's, like, a historical fiction. So, I guess everyone's faulted and you just pick your anti-hero, I suppose. But anyway, though, the very, very, very last, like, cut, the last, like, camera movement in this, after he said crimson sky it will be, like, oh, you guys, we all tried to avoid this, but let me pull this plan that I, you know, made years and years ago, that I don't know, it came from the heavens, I guess, because I never wanted to be shogun, but just in case, plan Z, here's this mm-hmm. thing.
So in this episode, he said, never, never. I'm pretty sure never will be. He's like, I'll never be shogun or something like that. I never will make it happen or something like that. And it's like literally like two scenes later. okay. I'll be shogun.
Yeah. Right. They twisted my arm and manifested this.
Sort of that Michael Corleone, pull me back in. Thing, we're like, you were never really out, Michael.
No, how dare you? I think Michael 100% wanted out. Come on, don't put Michael here. Michael wanted out, man. He is not a Toranaga. This is more like Jon Snow. I don't want to be king. I don't want to be king.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Shut up, you whiny little bitch. Okay, anyway. So back to that amazing last scene. Again, this was like, yeah, it was a dense episode. There was a lot happening, some confusion, lots of realizations. But, you know, when he said his speech and then like he said, we must defend, or I must defend this, the Taiko and Crimson Sky will be, that he said he'll send a message to his brother and then they'll go to Osaka with like whatever they have left as an army. And then the camera pans to like everybody down the line. Did you guys see? It was so first it was Mariko. Like it showed all of his allies. It was Mariko and she looks sad. And then Toranaga, who's like saying his speech with like his powerful face. And then Blackthorn, who's like confused and worried. And then it just goes down the line of the people who are stuck with him, which is Hiromatsu, then his son, who is Nagakado, which I was saying his name wrong the entire time last during our last episode.
I just thought you'd be sort of so lazy about it. I thought, nah, I got it. So, sort of like George Bush and Saddam Hussein.
You know what? That, yeah, that was exactly what I was doing. I am in Texas, so I had to represent. You're right. Thank you. But I'm not doing that today. Nagakato. Then it was Yabu Omi, and then it stopped at Buntaro. And I think, like, it's really, it was a really powerful scene, because so far we've been, well, you, Paul, have been talking about how, like, Yabu and Omi, like, where are they gonna side? Are they gonna be with Toranaga? Are they just gonna be these little mavericks and go rogue? Blah, blah, blah. And I'd like to say I was right. Look at that. Yabu has no choice.
He's been backed into a corner.
Yeah, I thought that it was really cool that, like, you finally see this. It's like, this is the fellowship right here. And Yabu didn't want to be part of it. I feel like Omi eventually did come around. I think he was just, like, trying to make Yabu happy. But he also was just like, I'm kind of just trying to, like, be alive because I had a good thing going and I want to keep it. And anyway, it stopped at Buntaro. And so that made me think that, and Buntaro had his face that was completely, like, ready. Like, everyone else kind of seemed like, oh, fuck. But he was 100% fucking ready. And so I think that he's going to be, like, a really huge character for, like, their victory. That's going to have to happen in the next couple of episodes. And it also, like, went to show and reinforce, like, I guess my theory of, like, this long game thing, right? Of Mariko, like, only being alive by proxy of, like, Buntaro because of Toronaga's hand. So his, like, strongest puppets, I guess, his strongest one, I guess, his biggest ally is Buntaro. And again, we didn't really see him before. And now, though, everybody is united. And then we don't really have this inappropriateness happening between Blackthorn and Mariko either. Like, we got that out of their system. And so, again, like, I see this as, like, the fellowship of the ring conversation. And now it's, like, the end of the... It was the end of the second episode of the second season, right? Two Towers, right? When they're going up the mountain and they're, like, walking through the rocks. No, that was the first one, because Homeboy was... Fuck, why can't I think of Lord of the Rings? Paul,
Boromir?
Come on.
You're thinking of Boromir?
No, Boromir was in that scene. So it was, like, the intermission of the first of the first movie. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, I felt that moment. That moment was happening. And it was big. It was powerful. Like, I was blown away by that ending. Sorry. Very long-winded way of getting to that point, that I was totally blown away by seeing the fellowship.
Of the guys you're stuck with.
Yeah. And what's to come.
Inez, any final thoughts on this episode before we allow ourselves to go to sleep today?
I just want to commend again all the details from the costumes, the makeup, and acting, just everything, just from a technical perspective of everything from the making of the episode. It was just really, really beautiful.
I did notice that in the tea house, Mariko's outfit, I feel like, was different, like, for that occasion versus other what we've seen before. It was, like, extra pretty and feminine, and it was black, but it was, I don't know if the colors signified anything, but I did notice costume changes, and that was really, really pretty.
Speaking of costumes, this is hopefully a quick answer. What did you get from when Kiku first arrives and Mariko sees her and she readjusts some of her folds on her robes a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, she also didn't translate everything between Blackthorn and her during both of the translation sessions. So I definitely took that as, obviously, she likes this guy and she knows that this is a beautiful woman who, like, is amazing at her art, and she's about to, like, seduce her man. So her fantasy man. So yeah, I thought that was just, like, I guess one of those, like, pointing out this little feminine rivalry, whatever.
I thought it was really cute. It because, you know, she doesn't have a whole lot in her life. She lives in the darkness, and this is the first time that she's experienced or exhibited a warmth or something that other people have caught on, right? This is obviously a significant impact on her with her relationship with him. And I love these little bits they did. So it was like the rope adjustment. Also, the specific translations when he's describing how like the women in his country are drab and disgusting, and then she translates, oh, he prefers the way that the women in his homeland. That was so funny. And then whenever she's like dropping Blackthorn off, when Kiku is dropping Blackthorn off and asking her to tell him, I would please let him know that I would love to have him again, to come back. And she didn't say any of that.
She's like, she's honored.
She's honored. Yeah, that was so funny. Yeah. I really loved
it. That's great.
Yeah, I loved it too. But knowing what's to come with my little Mariko, I also hated it. I'm like, I don't want to see her anymore. Just let it happen and let's move on. I can't do this.
Well, friends, it has been 2 full hours.
Why do you need to call us out like that, Paul? Come on.
Enlightening discourse, where I hope we've all learned something, especially Gabby, about new perspectives and other points of view.
You hope I learned that?
Yeah,
that's... yeah, we do. He said what he said. Oh, he's the leader. God. He's the leader. Okay. Just end it. Let him finish.
That's funny. No, this has been very instructive.
My bad.
No. You've helped me see new ways to look at these episodes, because in some ways, when it's got this guy main character, it's kind of built for me to look at the episodes through his experience. You know, that's more or less the way they make things now. So that's the first way I consider pretty much everything that I look at in this episode. So it's great to get another way of looking at these things that are done with a lot more care than maybe I catch on that first pass. So I doff my cap to you.
Oh, where's that applause?
It's right here.
Go ahead and click that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Well, if you have enjoyed our podcast and have stuck around this long, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon, or YouTube, or wherever you listen to podcasts, so that other people can find it, and it helps the algorithm and the rest of the channel and all that good stuff.
Yeah, like and subscribe, all of those.
And comment. And we'll be back next week for part 7. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.